Good morning.
Good morning.
So this morning I'm going to talk about enlightenment. Enlightenment. So all Buddhism, or I should say maybe 90% of Buddhism, comes from Buddha's own teaching, which is the promise of enlightenment, which he experienced and which he tried to live out once he'd experienced it, and then which he taught, the promise of enlightenment. And the practice that we do, meditation, is a practice in the service of moving toward enlightenment. And we do it slowly, patiently, and tenderly. Tenderly. We have to be tender with all the stuff that comes up as we're practicing, because mostly unenlightened stuff comes up. Mostly yucky stuff comes up. We have to be very tender and very patient, or we just want to forget about it. Forget about it. But enlightenment is our true nature and our true home. And the complexities and entanglements that we develop in our consciousness cause us to forget our true home. Our true home. These elaborate structures of habit, these palaces and prisons in the air that we create, maintain, and sustain. In our Zazen practice, in our meditation practice, we have an opportunity to to see those and let them dismantle themselves. Because if we try to dismantle them, it doesn't work. We just create more. We create a new prison, the one that's trying to dismantle the other prison, right? So we're just slow and patient and tender. Tender. Very important to be tender. And enlightenment is called, both in Sanskrit and Bodhi, and excuse me, Sanskrit and Pali, Bodhi. Bodhi. As in Bodhi Dharma, Bodhisattva, Bodhi. Lots of people have Dharma names that include Bodhi. Now, I don't want to start off by creating a misimpression about enlightenment. After enlightenment, bananas still taste like bananas. Harsh words still feel harsh. But we're aware of how everything permeates everything else. Everything penetrates everything else. And we're lit from within. Everything's lit from within. From the same undivided light. The same undivided light. That's why it's called enlightenment. And the metaphor that's most often used in the texts and scriptures is the moon, the light of the moon. Not the light of the sun, but the light of the moon. That's interesting. Dogen's well known for the phrase, a moon and a dewdrop. So the moon casts its glow on everything. And in contrast to the sun, the moon is calming. It's got a warmth, but not a heat. A calming warmth. And you experience this when you go outside and you see a full moon or just a quarter moon and you've been doing Zazen. Maybe you experience it when you haven't been doing Zazen. You experience this. So, the light of the moon. A realization that nothing is left out of this warm glow of the moon. And Dogen says even when the moon is half moon or quarter moon, or no moon, it's still shining. It is. It's still shining. So here's a poem from a 12th century Buddhist nun, Japanese Buddhist nun's enlightenment experience. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky. I knew myself completely, no part left out. Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Izumi Shikibu. So we're no longer exiles in these palaces, prisons, in the air. No, we realize that all life is joined within us. And so-called Tim becomes fluid and melts so we can participate fully in the constant flow of everything. Of everything. Nevertheless, some people can have openings and still behave like jerks. The glow of the moon has to penetrate us completely in our everyday lives. Let life teach us how to embody this wonderful glow. Let life teach us how to embody this wonderful glow. So, Katagiri Roshi's most recent book, which Andrea Martin has been talking about, is titled The Light That Shines Through Infinity. The Light That Shines Through Infinity. Zen and the Energy of Life. So enlightenment is the way each of us thinks, feels, and acts when we're aware of and participating in this huge energy that's manifesting itself as us. As us! Wow! What a deal! Can you believe it? First you have to believe it, then you have to practice, then you experience it. Then you practice some more. And you experience it some more until the you is just fluid. Fluid. It isn't something that can be obtained. The fear-based self has to crack open. Nagarjuna says, when Buddhas don't appear and their followers are gone, the wisdom of awakening bursts forth by itself. When Buddhas don't appear and their followers are gone, the wisdom of awakening bursts forth by itself. Here's a pre-Buddhist, this is from the Vedas, pre-Buddhist description of enlightenment, which is quite long. It will take me a little while to read. A doll of salt, after a long pilgrimage, this is a salt doll, right? A salt doll. After a long pilgrimage on dry land, came to the sea and discovered something she had never seen and could not possibly understand. She stood on the firm ground, a solid little salt doll, and saw there was another ground that was mobile, insecure, noisy, strange, and unknown. She asked the sea, but what are you? And it said, I'm the sea. And the doll said, what is the sea? To which the answer was, it's me. Then the doll said, I cannot understand, but I want to. How can I? The sea answered, touch me. So the doll shyly put forward a foot and touched the water. And she got a strange impression that it was something that began to be knowable. She withdrew her leg, looked, and saw that her toes had gone. And she was afraid and said, oh, but where is my toe? What have you done to me? And the sea said, you have given something in order to understand. Gradually, the water took away small bits of the doll's salt, and the doll went farther and farther into the sea. And at every moment, she had a sense of understanding more and more, and yet of not being able to say what the sea was. As she went deeper, she melted more and more, repeating, but what is the sea? But what is the sea? At last, a wave dissolved the rest of her, and the doll said, it is I. So, dying to the small self and opening up to just this, to just this. Lots of Chinese Zen stories about enlightenment. So many, you know, you kind of get tired of them. Well, at least I kind of get tired. The tuck of a stone hitting the bamboo after a person's been meditating, the sudden appearance of cherry blossoms across a ravine, on and on and on. The Blue Cliff Records probably has 50 of these, 60 of these. Paul Eluard said, there is another world, and it is inside this one. There is another world, and it is inside this one. Sometimes we call that, I call that opening to heart mind. Opening to heart mind. Heart mind, which has two gates. The first opens to vastness. The second to compassionate engagement with others. With others who are suffering. Compassionate engagement. So we still have delusions, but they're no longer capable of binding us to their limited tether. They still arise. We see them for what they are, and we feel compassion. We can feel compassion. Some of the same delusions we carry for our whole lives, because we have stuff that happened to us in our childhood, and those wounds never go away. They never go away. You think you're going to transcend those. Good luck. But you can have compassion. You can open your hearts. Instead of thinking you should have outgrown that. You can't outgrow it. Just come back to it. Take care of it. We still have bodies that break down. I can get up here, but my body is breaking down. We still face conflict. But we discover that we have a natural empathy. Tolstoy said, the day I came across my own inside, I came across everybody's inside. The day I came across my own inside, I came across everybody's inside. Everybody's. So I've been teaching a class on the Zen poet and fool and master Ryokan. And I talked in class last week or the week before about how the scholars debating whether Ryokan is enlightened or not. Big debate. Whole chapter full of debate whether Ryokan is enlightened. And so the issue that they're bringing up is, can a person be enlightened who has not transcended normal emotions? Who still gets sad? Who still gets lonely? Who still gets angry? Who still gets scared? And the answer is yes. Because there is the overall Buddhist view of enlightenment, which I've been talking about, and then there's the slight qualification of the Buddhist view, and I would say modification, qualification, and more precise articulation by Dogen. And Ryokan is a disciple of Dogen. It's a few centuries later, but he's still a disciple. So Ryokan is a great example of what Dogen's talking about when he talks about enlightenment, because he talks about at oneness with each activity, total openness to the wonder of just doing something, of just being. For Dogen, and for us, for my teacher Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi, it's a process and not a spectacular event. The spectacular event is right now. In the process, even though it might be painful, that's a spectacular event. So Dogen, when he talks about enlightenment, he almost always says, practice enlightenment, one word. Practice enlightenment, practice enlightenment. Shohaku Okamura was a guiding teacher here and talked a lot about that. Practice enlightenment, one word. This at-oneness with each activity repeated over and over in each new event. It's possible. And there's never an end to practice. Practice goes on forever. So I'm sipping my water. And somebody, I want to thank the person who put it on my left side, because I'm left-handed. I'm sipping my water. It tastes pretty good. And if I just sip it without worrying about you guys or what I'm going to say next or what I said last or what I should have said or what I might have said or what I could have said, right? If I'm just sipping my water, it engulfs all other activities and swallows up the past and future. Wow, what water! This is the deal here. It swallows up the past and future. Dogen says, the time when continuous practice is manifested is what we call now. It's what we call now. So practice enlightenment has to occur over and over, endlessly, as each activity is experienced as selfless openness, in selfless openness. Dogen calls this intrinsic enlightenment, which he says is a wonderful practice. So practice is always a practice of enlightenment. The smallest details of ritual, zazen, manual labor, eating, bathing, social engagement, practice is always the practice of enlightenment. So meditation then, in our tradition, is stripped of its older traditional instrumental function. That means in order to function. I'm doing this in order to get calm, in order to get enlightenment. It's stripped of that because the practice itself, if we're intimate with it, is enlightening. It lightens us up and we feel connected. We feel connected, some deep connection. It starts as a superficial connection, but after a while the connection is so deep that it's everything else is secondary to that connection. So constantly in our practice, we're developing the samadhi of zazen, meditation, eating, going to the toilet, even planning our day. People think, well, planning your day. Yes, planning your day. If you just plan your day, one thing at a time, get your list, just do it. Don't worry about before and after. Just breathe, stay calm. Sure, why not? It's enlightening. It's enlightenment as anything, isn't it? Enlightenment. Practice enlightenment, then, is intimacy in any form. So I taught the mindfulness at work at St. Thomas, and I had about 65 people a few months ago. That was cool, and we did. I had them practice the intimacy of sitting meditation, walking meditation, eating meditation, journaling, practice enlightenment, practice enlightenment, practice enlightenment. And then deeply listening to others, deeply listening to others. And that's the one, when I got the avowals back at the end of the day, that's the one they appreciated the most. It was just sitting and having conversation when you felt really listened to, really heard. Because we're so fast and we're so stirred up in our lives that we don't take the time to really listen to each other, to really watch each other, to really be with each other. Out of all the activities, that's what they voted in their avowal. That's the one that they was the most precious to them. So, conversation enlightenment, listening enlightenment, listening enlightenment, deeply listening. So since our meditation is not in order to, our bare awareness doesn't kick out anything. It doesn't kick out anything. This is what category is, we're used to this all the time. You want to kick things out. You can't kick anything out. Everything's here. You can try, but it's like the tar baby, it's gonna come back and get you. So when I was a young man practicing, I had lots of thoughts about my father and my conflicts with my father and having not done the things that I was supposed to do and my feelings about that and his feelings about me. So if I'm practicing bare awareness, and I did my best, then all of those words said and unsaid that form my attitude toward my dad came up. But rather than dissing them as much as possible, I returned to them and just was with them without judging, without evaluating, and began to experience the fear underneath them, the fear that glued them together, without judging, without evaluating. And that's real intimacy. That's really enlightening our delusion, as Dogen would say, enlightening our delusion. Takes radical acceptance for real intimacy to occur. No attempt to transcend anything. My thoughts about my dad at that time in my life were a realization of something about my relationship with him, something about my pain and his pain. So I was angry at him for doing X as much as possible, not suppressing, not repressing, not magnifying, not generalizing, not judging, and then not judging the fact that I've been judging, right? Just coming back. Tenderly. Katagiri Roshi used to call this digesting. Digesting in your meditation. Digesting. Progress does occur, but it occurs through intimacy with what is. And through that, there is a radical acceptance that occurs naturally, and then we naturally move into kind speech and kind action. Naturally. We liberate our speech, we liberate our action, so that it becomes not just fake. It's authentic. And then, as Dogen says, we go beyond Buddha. Enough of this Buddha stuff. Go beyond Buddha, which means right here, our home, which we've exiled ourselves from up in our palaces and our prisons. So Dogen says, the dream of a supreme enlightenment is enlightenment itself. So I talked about this to my Ryokan class. So after I've been practicing maybe for a year or so, practicing seriously, I went home and saw my father. He did not approve of this whole deal. And of course, then practicing meditation was considered a very marginal activity. You had to be really kind of out of it. Now, it ain't anymore. It's pretty cool. But then, my dad thought, what is he up to? What is he up to? He dropped out of one of the best universities in the country. He's sitting with this little Japanese man who looks really weird. He's chanting this really weird chant, which is indecipherable. My father actually, I gave him the Heart Sutra, he said, after spending a day on it, he said, what was that? He said, did these people go to high school even? These people who wrote this? That's what my dad said. And I said, well, I called him Daddy. Daddy, this is about settling into a timeless calmness that's right here. And he said, you're dreaming. You are dreaming. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. We're dreaming. We're going to free all these sentient beings? Pick up the paper. Listen to CNN. Watch CNN. Watch Fox News. if you have to. We're going to free all beings? We're dreaming. But if my commitment to this dream is wholehearted, if it's wholehearted, that's my enlightenment. My wholehearted commitment to this dream. When I'm intimate with my dream and my delusions, I enlighten them. I enlighten them. They lighten up. To enlighten my shortcomings and keep my vow is continually to practice beyond Buddha. Right? Don't need Buddha. Buddha's something extra. The enlightenment of my impossible dream. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. So in early Buddhism, dreams, illusion, delusions are like cataracts that you have in your eye. You have cataracts. And they refer to cataracts in the early scriptures as flowers blooming in the sky. I've never had cataracts, but that's kind of a, I don't know, flowers blooming in the sky. My wife had them. I haven't asked her. If they're flowers, they were unpleasant flowers because she sure didn't like it. Flowers blooming in the sky. And so the early Buddhists say, well, through practice, you get rid of your cataracts. You get rid of your dim-sightedness. But in our style of Buddhism, our way of Buddhism, the way my teacher did it and the way I do it, our dim-sightedness, we value. We're all dim-sighted. Doesn't matter how many enlightenment experiences you have, you're dim-sighted. And we radically accept our dim-sightedness and see how precious our dim vision is. How precious that we can have a little vision, that we can move towards something that we deeply care about. It's never going to be clear. It'll be clear for a little while, and then you'll go for it, and then it'll get dim. But that's wonderful. Because of Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi's dim vision, when they were in Japan as young men, we're here today. We're here today. So, my hearing is going. I have two hearing aids now. If I don't want to hear my wife, I just take them both out. That's pretty good. But actually, I do want to hear her most of the time. So I try to keep them in. In fact, I want to hear her all the time, even when she's mad at me. I want to hear her. Because then I can be there for her, with her. I need to hear her. But my hearing is going. So, and it has been going for years. It's getting worse and worse and worse. So my hearing is dim. But it gives me an opportunity to pay more careful attention. More careful attention to people's body language, to what I pick up from them kind of psychically. I don't know, I'm not really psychic, but maybe a little bit. Just to pick up from the vibes. So as my hearing diminishes, my opportunity for practice is deeper. It's deeper to be intimate, to do practice enlightenment. And as for delusion, we're all equally flawed. We're all equally flawed. Dogen says there's the principle of the way that we must make one mistake after another. If we're enlightened without delusion, there's a good chance we'll be totally ignorant of our actions. So, how can we skillfully enlighten our delusion? How can we skillfully enlighten it? And I suggested three ways in my Ryokan class, and I added a fourth for this morning. First, trust our dim vision. What is it that we really want to be and do? What do we deeply most care about? Even if it's dim. Life is short. And each of us has our own sense about what we really care about, what we really want in this remaining time. And fumble around with your dim vision. Since it's dim, you're going to fumble around. That's part of the practice. That's practice enlightenment. Number two, embrace not knowing. Embrace going beyond Buddha. Going beyond Buddha. Because if you're going to manifest your dim vision, you're kind of going to bring it alive, you won't know. You don't know. You don't know. But yeah, you have it. It's here, inside. Number three, take risks. Take risks, but risks in service of your dim vision. Risks in service of that. Allow yourself to make one mistake after another. I know you look stupid. I know it'll hurt when you fall down. I know that people will think you're weird. But in service of your dim vision, allow yourself to make one mistake after another. You can't make all the good choices. You can become an expert at falling down, though. Falling right on your face. You can become an expert. So I became the guiding teacher here about 16 years ago. And my dim vision was I wanted to do something that would be here that would make things a little more palatable for Americans who really wanted to practice deeply, but were not into all of the formality, all of the robes, and all of the rituals that my Japanese teachers brought from Japan. So that was my dim vision, and I didn't know. And I went out to breakfast with Karen Suno, who was the guiding teacher here before me, and I talked to her about it. She said, "Oh, that's good. You should do that." I said, "Yeah, but I don't know how to do it. I don't want to upset things." She said, "Oh, well, maybe you could on Sunday. It might be a good time to have not so much formality and be more stripped down and more or less just regular." And she said, "But then," and I said, "Yeah, well, I've been thinking about Sunday." And she said, "Yeah, but maybe you should do it outside Zen Center. Maybe you should go to some church or some community center and do it on Sundays there." Well, that wasn't my dim vision. I didn't know, but that wasn't my dim vision. It didn't feel good to me. I thought there's got to be some things. So I didn't know, but then I took a risk. I thought, well, we'll just do all of our formal stuff Monday through Thursday. And if you come Monday through Thursday, you'll see we do all the formal stuff with all the ritual and everything. And Saturday, but Sunday we won't do that stuff. And then we'll have practice that sometimes, and I'll use the word contemporary, nobody likes that, but you have to have some word, and some that's traditional. Some of our retreats would be contemporary and some traditional. And a bunch of people left. And I thought, I don't know if I cried, but I cried inside. Oh. But I still had my dim vision. And I tried to just... Well, then some other people started coming, so that was okay. And then some other people came back, but I still didn't know. And then I started ordaining people, but I didn't want to call them priests, because priests, that's Catholic priests. We're in the world. We have families and jobs and responsibilities. So what would I call them? Well, I call them sort of, I didn't have anything to call them. I don't remember even what we called them. I know that Kim was so frustrated with me that she started calling them priestly types because I wouldn't use the term priests. So finally, I fell down on that one. I came back and I said, they can be priests. They can be in the world. They don't have to be Catholic priests. They can have families and careers. Well, I stumbled around. And here we are. But I don't know what the next iteration is going to be for me as I'm on the wane here. Maybe Ted's going to be the dim vision guy who's embracing not knowing and taking risks, and I'm just going to be in back being wise. giving profound advice out of my infinite wisdom. And the fourth thing is, in our practice, the first three, trust your dim vision, embrace not knowing, take risks. And the fourth thing is, keep showing up on your cushion. Do retreats. Absorb the teaching. Get the teaching in you. You can get this teaching in you so deeply that it becomes your basic way of being just by doing it. Just by doing it. With an open mind and a whole heart, and the promise that you have a home here that is right here waiting for you to come back to anytime you practice enlightenment. Anytime. Trusting that. So enlightenment isn't a light as opposed to darkness. Dark is the undifferentiated unity, and the light is the manifest world. Wow! Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Learn to live our enlightenment, each in our own way. Each in our own way. So my teachers offered to me their warm hand, their warm hands in the intimacy of practice enlightenment. And I offer my warm hands to you. My hands got warm during this practice. I don't know how. And you can offer them to others. And that's what we do. Practice enlightenment. That's what we do. So that's what I want to say for this morning. And I'm glad to entertain questions or comments from anyone. Benton.
You mentioned your father being a little bit judgmental.
A little bit judgmental.
Just coming in here. I heard somebody rather judgmental this morning. I was walking in, somebody was in front of me, and she kept looking back at me, and I said, "Oh, I'm not following you. I'm just going to the same place that you are." She said, "Where's that?" And I said, "The Zen Center." She said, "Oh, did you know that place is a cult?" Why do you think that? And she said, "Because they're not Christian."
Oh.
There's Christians there. Oh, you can't serve two gods.
You can serve eight gods, 80 gods, 80,000 gods. Did you tell her that?
I said we don't serve a god.
Oh, God serves us.
Right. And she was starting to get a little hateful and going different directions, uh-huh. Challenger. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. As she was walking away, she said, "Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation."
Interesting. Yeah.
She needs to talk to a Hindu.
Yeah.
Talk to what?
A Hindu.
Uh-huh.
Just how many gods are there?
Mm-hmm. No. Thanks, Benton. Yes, that's true. So, meaning that we get divided. Religion divides us a lot. Mm-hmm. As human beings, a lot. Sad. What else? Yeah.
So I was hearing your dim vision as faith. And I guess, do you have another response to what Benton said? Is that a sort of blind faith or just different faith, misguided faith? Would you not call that this sort of use of faith?
Okay, so you guys couldn't hear him, could you? Can you just say that a little louder?
I was hearing that your description of dim vision as faith. So I'm wondering if the view of from this woman that Benton was talking about is that a delusion faith or is it not faith?
So he's asking. Could you guys hear that? He's asking about. They could hear it this time. Well, I prefer the word trust to faith. We have trusting in our dim vision. Now, why do I prefer the word trust? Because faith to me, I'm trying to think this through. Faith to me connotes some sense of belief or movement toward perfection. This is just for me. Whereas trust is, I'm trusting that if I clear out somewhat all this stuff that I'm focused on, that I can trust my own ability to move towards something deep and interconnected with people. And it's going to manifest it itself in its own way. It's not faith in a being or a belief. It's a dim vision. Because as soon as we get faith in a being or a belief, then we divide ourselves from someone else's faith or belief. So that's the way I think about it. How is that for you?
That's a good answer for me.
Pardon?
That's a good answer, first of all. I guess when I was hearing your talk, I was thinking that faith is the word I came up with, and the trust in making mistakes. It makes me curious about your class, actually, about, I was also hearing being a fool is okay.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to do this, if you're going to take risks and follow your dim vision, sometimes you're going to be really... You're not only going to fall, you're going to look really foolish. People are going to think, he is weird. She is weird. That's okay. That's okay. No problem. We have a whole history of weirdness in our tradition. Yeah.
So, I work in a group home with guys who have traumatic brain injuries.
Uh-huh.
And one of my clients is very, very, very religious. Like, every other sentence out of his mouth is, praise Jesus.
Uh-huh.
But he functions at a low enough level that he's not differentiating. He's not like dividing because of that. It's just, and so I find myself when I communicate with him, translating what I know from my practice here into his Christian language, and we get along pretty good.
Well, that's wonderful. You can praise Jesus with him.
Exactly.
I'll come praise Jesus with you guys. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. No division. Intimacy. Cool. Good for you. Other people. Steve.
You see this poem by this nun in the 12th century.
Yeah.
She's Japanese. She might actually precede Dogen.
Yeah, she does.
What language is that?
She's not a nun, actually. It's Japanese. She's a Buddhist practitioner, but not a nun. You can look her up online. She's interesting. She's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, you see the at this interesting. The moon usually is full at midnight. Here it's dawn, right between midnight.
And
full noon, high noon. So
yeah,
there might be some play with form and emptiness there with that image.
There could be. Yeah. Thank you. Carrie.
What really spoke to me in your talk today was about listening, fully listening. And like you said, when you brought this to St. Thomas business people,
that
really high.
Yeah.
With what's been going on in the world and the recent mass shooting, to me, that just that again brings up that how important listening is.
Uh-huh.
You know, to really listening to a person, to making that connection, to building a relationship, because here's another person in our world who didn't feel connected.
Yeah.
Didn't feel listened to.
Yeah.
Didn't have a relationship healthy enough, strong enough, you know, to have them make a different choice.
Yeah. Good. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.